Blog Talk Radio.
Father, make light my prayer and strong my faith. Swift my feet and sure my hand to carry your will to the ends of the earth and spread the good news of your love through the land. Make peaceful the night and bright the day, with angels calling the rising suns. Now high is the road and clear is the way, and finding your presence has just begun. Oh, that the one who has caused the earth to turn and the stars in their crowning glory to bless the skies with a kingly prize could stay so near to my praying. Father, make strong my heart to know your love and assure my faith to stand on, holding the earth in the palm of your hand. We are your faith-bound children.
Good morning and welcome to the Cosmic Citizen. This is Blog Talk Radio, and this is Paula Thompson coming to you from beautiful Colorado. I'm waiting for my good friend Andre to call in. He's supposed to have David Cantor, our guest, with him. So I apologize for the delay. I hope we won't be waiting too long, though. In the meantime, perhaps one of you good friends can call in, and we can chat about the subject coming up, which is Christianity and the Urantia book, essentially, and the part that Christianity plays and the part that the Urantia book might play to leaven the dough of Christianity. I have some pretty strong opinions about the foundation that the Urantia builds, the Urantia teachings build on. I believe they build on the Judeo-Christian foundation for a very good reason. And namely, that that foundation is there for a reason, and that foundation represents, at least for me, the strongest religious foundation on the planet. The reason Jesus came to the world, to the Jewish faith, was for that same reason. The reason the Urantia book came to a predominantly Christian culture, and the reason that the Urantia book is predominantly Christian. So, and that's not to associate it with any culture per se, but I think there are reasons for this, and I think that we need to honor them. So here is Andre. I'm going to put him through. Andre, is it you?
I am here, and David is with us. Are you there, David?
Hey.
I'm here. Good morning, everyone.
Well, I'm trying to punt. Fill in a little time. If I'd have had the Don Green interview, I would have played it, but it wasn't there anymore.
Oh.
I don't know what happened to that, but perhaps.
Okay, well, Paul, I'm sure you did it. You did quite an introduction. So let me go ahead and sort of restate some things here. Today we're going to, the Urantia book tells us that Christianity contains more of Jesus's enough of Jesus' teachings to immortalize it. And, you know, it doesn't say that about any other religion that I know of. And with that spirit, I am particularly interested in our and not just interested, I'm excited, really, to have our guest this morning, who is David Cantor. David Cantor serves on the he's an IT director for the Fellowship for Readers of the Urantia Book. He also has been a scholar of the book for years and years. How long have you been reading, David?
Well, I started reading in 1966.
Wow. Okay. Anyway,
David is coming to us all the way from Lithuania, friends. So.
Yes, that's true. He is. that thanks to the glories of Skype, and I hope you guys can hear David pretty well, because I know last week we had a hard time with Skype when we were interviewing Bob Koch. But anyway, David has come up with a very interesting idea, and that is to start a Christian Urantia Society. David, why do you want to do that?
Well, there are a number of reasons, and I must say that I came to this position over a long, arduous course, because I was raised in a very strict Christian fundamentalist family, and I couldn't stand Christianity. I was so glad to find the Urantia Book. But, you know, over the years, as I've read the Urantia Book and I've tried to analyze what is it that the revelators are telling us that we ought to do. In fact, it's a good exercise to go through the book and make a list of all those things. My opinion has changed on this. You know, once you recognize the fact of the centrality of Jesus in your personal religion, and you appreciate that he also comprises the centrality of the religious beliefs of almost a third of the global population, you need to spend some time considering the implications of this. You know, if Jesus is central to your faith and belief, if you believe you have some important information about his life and teachings, what are your moral obligations to other human beings who also attempt to live their lives around the same centrality of his presence? And just one more quick point here. You've got thousands of clergy, missionaries, laypersons struggling to carry on the master's work with extremely limited resources in a demanding and difficult world. Are we going to abandon these folks or help them find the conceptual reinforcement and support they need to do the master's work? There are thousands of dedicated kingdom workers scattered around the world, living amazing lives of service. How do we help these heroic agendaunters?
Wow. You know, okay, but because first of all, everybody should know that I totally agree with you. In fact, I actually have written an article, David, which you've read yourself, called The Urantia Book and My Christian Faith, which is going to be in the Fellowship Herald. It's also in the UAI Journal, and I told David he can post anywhere he wants. So I actually agree with everything you're saying, but I'm going to play the devil's advocate for a minute just because I know I can already hear and anticipate some of the objections that are going to be coming from maybe even some of our listeners who are going to say, well, isn't the Urantia Book for all religions? Why single out Christianity?
Well, I agree that it's for all religions. I'm singling out Christianity because I think it represents an area of great potential for dissemination. For one thing, consider the infrastructure. Consider the infrastructure. You know, when Melchizedek came, he had zero infrastructure. He had to start from scratch with his Salem schools. When Jesus came, he almost had to start from scratch. He used the infrastructure that John the Baptist began. Mm-hmm. Now, we've got 2,000 years of evolving infrastructure. Are we going to just abandon that and start over?
Okay, so what is it you're trying to do then with this virtual Christian Urantia Society? What is your vision?
Well, the vision is to have a society, a regular fellowship society, that consists of people who come from Christian backgrounds or who may be actually involved in Christian churches today. Just some place where these people can come together and share notes and help each other and hopefully develop some service resources that will interest other Christians in reading the Urantia Book.
Will this be an online community?
Well, I anticipate having a website that's dedicated to this with a discussion board and so on, but this is in an early stage of development. I'm still collecting lists of individuals who are interested in participating. We will go through the formal process of developing a constitution and working within the framework of the fellowship on this.
You know, I was saying before you guys came on that I feel very strongly that there is a reason that this book builds on those foundations, as I look at it from that standpoint, I see it as foundational. I just don't think you can knock out those foundations. And as much, as hard as it is, and my heart particularly goes out to people of the Jewish faith, because I've been told by friends who grew up Jewish that saying Jesus, in my friend Barbara told me once, if I were to say Jesus in my home, it was like saying a four-letter word. And that was pretty shocking to me to hear that. And I can understand how, you know, many Christians even now struggle with the notion, you know, that they left their faith because people beat them up in Jesus' name. And I can imagine how people of a Jewish of the Jewish faith feel. They've been brutalized in Jesus' name. And I think that's why the term Jesus becomes like a four-letter word, just like she said. But on the other hand, we have a new revelation. We have, you know, not that Christianity doesn't already love Jesus, they do, but I think there are some things that Christianity is lacking in their understanding of Jesus. And I think if they fully understood Jesus, the Jesus we know from the Urantia book, they would never do the things they've done in his name. There would have been no Inquisition. There would have been no persecutions. There would have been no Holocaust if Christianity had known the Jesus we know and had embraced true Jesusonian principles of faith and love and peace and understanding and goodwill. So, you know, I think our challenge as Urantia book readers is to present the Jesus we know and love in such a way as to illuminate his true value and his quality, and to show that, that, you know, I know it's hard. I know it's hard for certain faiths, especially Jewish faith, the Jewish faith, but it's also, I'm sure, going to be hard for Muslims, although they do embrace Jesus, at least as a prophet. But, you know, the Hindus don't seem to have a problem with Jesus, and the Buddhists don't seem to have a problem with him. So our issue then becomes, you know, that I've had this quote brought up so many times, David, where people say, you know, don't make the mistake of associating this religion with any one world culture. You know which quote I'm talking about?
Yes.
They always bring this up as an argument against what we're what you're talking about. And I would like your thoughts on that. What do you think about that quote? I tried to find it and I can't. So, Andrea, if you know which one I'm talking about, you know it.
I know that in paper 195 it talks about how Christianity must cease to sponsor the I can't remember something about Western civilization, how it needs to be. I don't remember the exact, but I want to just piggyback before I let you get a, go respond, David. Let me just piggyback on what Paula was saying. I agree with Paula completely. That there would be no Inquisition, no persecution of Christians if Christians had had a fuller understanding of the revelation of Jesus. Some of that came from the Old Testament God, which the New Testament writers unfortunately still believed in. Not that all the Old Testament is bad, but they still held on to some of the concepts of God as a wrathful God. And the other thing, though, I will say this: though the Holocaust, though, I would qualify that, though, because the Holocaust was actually not really done in the name of Christianity. Hitler used Christianity, but Hitler actually was a pagan and an occultist. He really wasn't a Christian. So it's one of those interesting things. But I will say, going back to David, I want to kind of again build on what Paula is saying, because one of the things that a lot of readers will say is they'll say, well, but the Urantia book criticizes Christianity. It says that we need to get back to the real unadulterated religion of Jesus, not Christianity. Christianity is just a gospel about Jesus. You know, and in fact, there are places where the book even talks about so-called Christianity. So how would you respond to that critique?
Let me quickly hit this quote that Paula asked about, and then I'll respond to your question. The quote that Paula asked about says, "No revealed religion can spread to all the world when it makes the serious mistake of becoming permeated with some national culture or associated with established racial, social, or economic practices. It's not talking here about religious associations in my interpretation of that quote. Would you ask me your question again, Andre?
Well, yeah, what I was going to say was, okay, my question to you was, a lot of, again, I'm just playing devil's advocate here for a minute.
Uh-huh.
And one of the objections I know would come from some readers would be, well, you know, the book is not here to promote Christianity. It's you know, the religion of Jesus is for all religions. And the religion is, and the book says we're supposed to get back to the unadulterated religion of Jesus. Christianity is just a gospel about Jesus. We need to get back to the gospel of Jesus. And there are even places in the book that talk about so-called Christianity. How would you respond to that critique?
Well, you know, it might be useful to make a distinction between Christianity and individuals who construct their lives around a Christian worldview. And by that I mean individuals for whom Jesus is the central character in their lives. That may help clarify that.
Well, and I also would say that there's a difference between Christianity and the Christian church, which I actually am a person who believes that Christianity is going to continue to thrive, but I think the church is going to look very different in 30 years than it does today. But I want to kind of go back to I'm going to actually, instead of playing devil's advocate here, I'm going to start agreeing with you now, okay? And I'm going to just say I want to quote someone that I talked to you about this off the air, David. But I want to introduce everybody. First of all, let everybody know that I'm a huge fan of a writer named Camille Paglia. She's spelled P-A-G-L-I-A, and her columns can be found at salon.com every month. And she's actually an atheist, but she has a really strong aesthetic appreciation for religion and religious values. And I want to just read a paragraph from her latest column, because I'll tell you guys why I'm reading it after I read it, because she's actually talking about the Cairo speech that Obama gave in Cairo to Muslims. And she said, "The Cairo speech will certainly not be Obama's final word on this important subject, which I hope will remain on the front burner throughout his presidency. But before he can sway hearts and minds, the president will need to show that he understands the ultimate divergence and perhaps incompatibility of major creeds. At the finale, his recitation of soft-focused quotes from the Quran, Talmud, and Bible came perilously close to a fuzzy New Age syncretism of all religions. Of all religions are the same, which they unequivocally are not. The problem facing international security is that people who believe something will always be stronger and more committed than people who believe nothing, which unfortunately describes the complacent passivity of most Western intellectuals these days." The thing I really want to jump on here, though, is her point that all religions are not the same. David, and I want everybody to know, I'm not against interfaith dialogue at all, and I know there are a lot of readers who are involved in it, but there's a common belief or perception, and unfortunately it's even crept, I think, into a lot of into at least some Urantropic readers' minds, even though they know this can't be true because they have a revelation in front of them. But the idea that, you know, that when you really strip away all the differences, all religions really are saying the same thing. And there are a lot of people who believe that. But that really isn't true. And if you really look at what the Urantropic says, yes, the Urantropic says we should have interfaith dialogue, but it also, and I'll be picking up some quotes on this as we go forward, it also says that some religions are more advanced than others. It says that some are less advanced. It criticizes Buddhism because Buddhism does not teach a personal God. So I guess I just want you to kind of respond to that, David. Don't you think the book is not politically correct when it comes to, it would not be considered politically correct these days when it comes to what it says about religion? I mean, yes, it says that all religions need to come together, but it does not say that all religions are ultimately the same.
I agree. You know, there's a Samuel Angus, one of my favorite books, is his kind of classic text titled Christianity and the Mystery Religions. It's a great book because it really goes into the religious environment of Jesus' times. But he maintains that Christianity took off in the Roman Empire because it actually stood for something within the pluralism that had come to prevail in the Hellenistic world following the conquest of Alexander. And we've got that pluralism today in our world, and this fuzzy relativism. And a lot of times religionists want to avoid conflict, they want to appear loving and compatible, and they end up sacrificing their position. You can't have a dialogue unless there are two positions being worked with. You know, we shouldn't give up those positions. The Judeo-Christian tradition is really different from the other world religions because it has a cosmology that's based on a historic worldview. If you look at Hinduism and Buddhism and the other world religions, their cosmology is cyclical in nature. It's not an evolutionary cosmology, and there are huge implications of that. You know, anybody, it's easy to experience the presence of God. Everyone has a thought adjuster. You've got seraphim. Every one of the world's religions and every, you know, hundreds of little cults and sects all have different ways in which people can go about finding the presence of God in their lives. That's not the problem. The issue is a supporting cosmology that will help us evolve a civilization and a culture that will enable us to express that presence of God in our lives more effectively. And that's where the revelation comes in. That's where the Judeo-Christian tradition comes in. I think it's very important. It should not be underestimated.
Well, you know, David, I'd like to go back to this this quote. Because this is the one that people keep throwing up as the reason not to pander to Christians or not to go out for Christians. I have always believed personally that it is what will launch the Urantia book majorly into the world scene will be some big Christian religion that will take it, that will accept it. I have always felt like this is what will bring it into the mainstream. Some big Christian religion, I don't know if it's
yes.
the Mormons or Unity or what, you know, is going to accept it openly and say, wow, this is our book. This one is, this is fabulous. And that's going to launch it like never before. But I could be wrong. I don't know. I just think that's a natural next step because there is nothing on this planet. I defy anybody, anywhere, to show me a more beautiful depiction of Jesus. I can't even imagine there's a more beautiful depiction of Jesus. It is splendid beyond words. To me, there isn't a word in the English language or any language probably good enough for it. If this isn't Jesus, if this isn't the real story of Jesus, I'd love to see it.
Well, you know that I agree with you completely.
Yes,
and,
I know you do.
You know, the issue, I think, is leadership. If you look at the history of Christianity, well, particularly in North America since the Revolution, you know, it's not a linear progression. It has its ups and downs. There were two periods of great awakenings, and in our lifetimes we had Billy Graham, remarkable human being in terms of bringing his best perception of the gospel of Jesus to people, and I believe that it will take leadership within Christianity somewhere. As you said, somewhere it will take off. It'll be some leader within some Christian denomination, I think, that'll really take it off. And you know, I want to quote Paul, the Apostle Paul, because his comment in 2 Corinthians, it's in 2 Corinthians 4:2. If we are successful in putting together this virtual Christian society, I would take this as one of the founding principles. Paul says in 2 Corinthians, he says, "We refuse to practice cunning or to falsify God's word, but by the open statement of the truth, we commend ourselves to the conscience of everyone in the sight of God." Isn't that beautiful?
Mm. Wow. I love it when you quote Paul. I love it when people quote Paul, David, because one of the things I've harped about with people is how many Urantia Book readers are biblically illiterate. I also find a lot of Urantia Book readers who I think misunderstand what the book is saying about Paul. They bash Paul. They say, oh, Paul,
yeah.
Because Abner said that Paul was a clever corrupter of the teachings of Jesus, but the book doesn't necessarily endorse what Abner said. It says that Paul was a compromiser, but compromise was not always a bad thing. I actually believe that Paul had to make some of those compromises because it was the only way that the teachings could be spread at the time. So compromise is not necessarily a bad thing. The book actually views compromise as a positive thing in a lot of places, and I don't want to digress here. But the only thing I would disagree with you, you on, Dave, is I do agree that the Christian, that Christians and Christianity is fertile soil for the spread of the Urantia book. I think it's probably the most fertile soil. The only thing I would disagree with you on is I think that it's not going to be spread through the Christian clergy or through, now it may be spread through a leader, but I think it's going to be a lay leader. I don't think it's going to be, I think the Christian clergy collectively are too sort of enmeshed in the status quo. I don't see that happening. I think that what I think is going to happen is I think you're going to see the distinction between clergy and laity kind of eroding, you know, in the future. And I think you're going to see, it's already happening. People are doing home Bible studies, you know, kind of just like what we do with study groups. And I think the as I said before, our sort of vision of what the Christian church is today is going to undergo a really huge redefinition.
I agree, and it's interesting to think that this could come from the grassroots rather than from some outspoken leader. It's very possible that it could come from the grassroots. One of the things I've considered is the rapidity with which translations have been done. Urantia Foundation has done a great job of getting translations out and published and scattered around the world. I mean, in 50 years, look, what are there, 10, 12 translations, maybe more? And I thought how curious it would be if the revelation penetrated existing cultures on the planet from the grassroots globally, all at the same time, not spreading from some center someplace, but just kind of emerging at a grassroots level. It would be a remarkable phenomenon.
Wow.
If you could
also tell us what you mean when you say, and I agree with you on this point, Dave, but tell us what you mean when you say that a lot of the other Eastern religions, for example, are cyclical rather than historical cosmologies. Explain that to the audience so they understand what that means.
Well, I say that because I get a sense of that from their scriptures, that reality is cyclical. It's a cycle, and it repeats itself. It's a circular process rather than an evolutionary process. It has a beginning and an intermediate and an end. And in some of those Eastern religions, that cyclical process, the whole purpose of your religious life is to try to escape from that cyclical process.
So how is that different from the Urantia book?
Well, the Urantia book portrays life as an evolutionary process that we participate in, and we are co-creators with God. Every decision that we make, every interaction we have with another human being is in some small way promoting or directing the course of evolution in the cosmos. We are co-creators. That's a big difference between the Judeo-Christian tradition and some of the Eastern religions. Here we are co-creators of an external reality. There the object is to escape from any external reality, which is often seen as an illusion or just a creation of mind.
So it's like being stuck in a rut, and in a sense, the Urantia book tells us that that is the mission of epical revelations, to get you unstuck, to get you out of the rut, and lift you up to a whole new level where you can again begin to see all of the wonderful possibilities that exist in
uh-huh.
the cosmos and in the magnificent being that we call our Creator.
Tell us,
you know, Andre, go ahead.
I was going to say, tell us, the one thing that Christianity has also done, well, one thing the Urantia book really stresses is the importance of a personal God. And that's something that's missing, by the way, in a lot of the central teachings of Eastern religions, although the need for a personal God was so great that it ended up developing, you know, certain sects within those religions ended up developing a personal God anyway. But I would say that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam probably have the most, you know, that's one of the central claims of their faith, is that God is a person, not just a force.
Right.
Would you say that Christianity, probably of all the major religions, do you think that Christianity has done more to advance the idea of God as a personal God than maybe even, do you think it's an overstatement to say that Christianity has done more to advance the concept of God as a person than any other religion?
Oh, I don't think I would say that, although I think that the life of Jesus demonstrates to us more about the qualities of that personality, and that's important. You know, if you go back to some of the Vedas, the early Vedas, the Rig Veda, these are very, very old, first committed to writing from old stories that go back to the Andites. There are some beautiful references to the personality of God there, to God as a personal being, but it kind of gets lost in some of the later writings. Very descriptive, very good. But again, I think the life of Jesus, it's important to study that because that's a revelation of the nature of God, of the nature of his personality.
Okay, I guess what I'm getting at here is, for example, Christianity accepts the Trinity, for one thing, which that even further personalizes God because that makes God relational. God is relating to other beings and the other persons of the Godhead, and has been for forever. As the Iranstra book says, God has always been a father, and a father can't be a father without a son. So that's where I would say I'm really not trying to bash other religions here. I'm just trying to be intellectually honest with what the Iranstra book says. I think that we can make a case that because Christianity accepts the Trinity, because it that's one of the things that makes Christianity superior to I would actually make the case that the Revelators consider Christianity to be, even despite its flaws like the atonement doctrine and other flaws, that it considers Christianity to be the most advanced, the highest religion that we've had. And I think that's one of the reasons why I would argue that the book primarily targets a Christian audience. You can see that in its quotes of Scripture. Even when it's correcting Scripture, it's still quoting Scripture. It quotes Scripture more than any other book.
Yeah.
And there's a question on the board that if we, directed toward you, David, and that is, then why emphasize Christianity if it isn't a higher vision of God?
You need to take a look at what the Urantia book does. It's very interesting the way the Urantia book revitalizes and reinforces the fundamental stories of the Judeo-Christian tradition. You know, Adam and Eve, Jesus, the Lucifer rebellion, concepts like guardian seraphim, it reinforces and revitalizes those fundamental elements of the story. That's really important. It's not a story about Krishna and Arjuna. It's a story about Jesus and his life, even though it does elevate and quote the Vedas and the Upanishads. It's fundamentally a Christian document.
It's even constructed
like a classic Christian systematic theology. I mean, take a look at it.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, David, and I was asking because it was posed, and I think it's a legitimate question, but I think that Christianity stands apart for me for two reasons. One, because it builds on the Judeo foundation. So that was the first layer. That was the first foundation that... The Revelators tell us that was the highest religion on earth at the time. The first to believe wholeheartedly in monotheism, that was huge. They tell us how huge that was. They had a superior family life. They had, so why did Jesus come as a Jew? Well, for all these reasons. And then this is a new revelation. Jesus is a new revelation in his own right. He is an apical revelation. We know that because we're Urantia book readers. Why is Christianity a powerful religion? Because he is at its center. And because he said, if you will hold me up in your lives, I will draw all to myself. All you have to do is hold me up. And I think there's obviously a literal and spiritual reason for that. Jesus is the center of this universe. He is spirit gravity. just as the eternal sun is spirit gravity in the universe of universes, Jesus is spirit gravity in this universe. He will literally draw all to himself, even if they don't understand him, even if they don't know him. He is a huge spiritual draw.
That's so important. You know, that's really important because... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, David.
It's important because it gets back to what Andre was saying about the personality of God. And he asked if Christianity hadn't done a lot to promote that idea. In my view, all of the religions of the book, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, yes, they have a concept of a personal God, but it's not the best person in the neighborhood. You know, it's portrayed as angry and wrathful and vengeful.
Right.
And that's why Jesus is important, because Jesus was God incarnated in the flesh. And if we look at his life, then we can understand more about the character of God, the qualities of his personality, how he interacts with creation and his creatures.
Exactly.
Yeah, I wanted to read a quote here. I've been searching. I normally don't do the show in front of my computer, but today I am, because I don't like using the cordless phone. But I've heard people say that they can still hear me. So you haven't had any complaints on the board that people can't hear me, have you?
Not you. No, they're having the typical issues about not being able to hear the show, and I don't know what we can do with Blog Talk to help.
Okay. I wanted to just read a quote, and I don't know where this is. It's in one of the papers in the Urantia book on Hinduism. I was just doing a Google search on it. That's usually how I find stuff from the Urantia book. But it's I wanted to just talk a little bit before about what you were saying earlier, David, about the cyclical nature of Eastern religion as opposed to the progressive, forward-looking nature of a lot of Western religions. Here's what it says. The undue concentration on self led certainly to a fear of the non-evolutionary perpetuation of self in an endless round of successive incarnations as man, beast, or weeds, and of all the contaminating beliefs which could have become fastened upon what may have been an emerging monotheism. None was so stultifying as this belief in transmigration, the doctrine of the reincarnation of souls, which came from the Dravidian Dakan. This belief in the weary and monotonous round of repeated transmigrations robbed struggling mortals of their long-cherished hope of finding that deliverance and spiritual advancement in death which had been a part of the earlier Vedic faith. This philosophically debilitating teaching was soon followed by the invention of the doctrine of the eternal escape from self by submergence in the universal rest and peace of absolute union with Brahman, the oversoul of all creation. Now, I want to just make some comments on some of this before I read further. And what we have here is the book is saying that Eastern religion, one of the greatest weaknesses, particularly Hinduism, was that it taught reincarnation. Now, why is that such a weakness? Well, because instead of going forward after we die, they were teaching that we would keep coming back and coming back and back in this endless round of cycles. And not only that, but Eastern religion also, a lot of people may not realize this, they don't believe in the existence of the individual. They don't believe that you, David, or I, or Paula, actually exist as people, that ultimately our individual identities are going to be sort of submerged into the universe, kind of like drops of water in the ocean, but we won't exist as individuals. Whereas, you know, the Urantia book, you know, just constantly says over and over and over, you know, the importance of personality. The reason I'm bringing this is not so much to bash Eastern religion, but to point out that the Urantia book builds on existing Judeo-Christian concepts, like life after death, in an eternal reality as opposed to repetitive reincarnations, like the reality of the individual human soul. Those are things that Western religions really stressed. I'll say not just Christianity, but Judaism and Islam, that those monotheistic religions, but I would, you know, again, I would say that Christianity, though, went even further by accepting the Trinity. But those are things, would you say, David, that the Urantia book builds on those philosophical concepts and those distinctions?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think so. Can you ask me more?
Well, I guess I want to, what I'm trying to get at here is why you're, what I'm trying to get at here is why, you know, I'm trying to sort of flesh out again here why you are choosing to focus on Christianity. You know, what do you think? What do you think the Revelators? How do you think the Revelators, you know, built on Christianity? I mean, you mentioned, for example, Adam and Eve, the other Judeo-Christian stories. What I'm also saying is, what do you think? Do you think that philosophically as well, in a lot of in many respects, do you think the Urantia book is building on existing Christian teachings or Judeo-Christian teachings?
Well, I would have to ask the question, what is at the heart of Jesus' teaching? What is at the heart? Certainly the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, but these are really for the kingdom. You know, it's the kingdom of heaven. If you read through all of Jesus' post-resurrection appearances and make a list of all the things he told people to do, it was spread the gospel of the kingdom around the planet. If we want to interface or interact with other religions, I think that this is how it needs to be done. Scholars need to find any references to the kingdom of heaven and develop those within the context of these other religious systems of belief. In Christianity, that concept of the kingdom is, I believe, more well developed, even in its stages that it's in today, than it is anywhere else. There's that quote about the cocoon that it's in the Urantia book. It says, the church is only the larval stage of the thwarted spiritual kingdom, which will carry it through this material age and over into a more spiritual dispensation where the master's teachings may enjoy a fuller opportunity for development. Thus does the so-called Christian church become the cocoon in which the kingdom of Jesus concept now slumbers. The kingdom of the divine brotherhood is still alive and will eventually and certainly come forth from this long submergence, just as surely as the butterfly eventually emerges as the beautiful unfolding of its less attractive creature of metamorphic development. So, you know, the book is telling us that, number one, the kingdom is going to come forth from this cocoon. So we need to ask, is the Urantia book something separate from this process, or is it something that is intended to be a part of this process?
Well, not only that, David, but, you know, not only that, but let's face it again. The book says the Christian church is the cocoon. It does, and again, I'm not trying to disparage interfaith dialogue here, but it doesn't say the mosque, it doesn't say the synagogue, it doesn't say the temple, it says the Christian church. So again, despite the book's critiques of Christianity, I think it is definitely building on, you know, again, once again, on the Christian foundation.
Well, there's also the quote that says Jesus did not found the so-called Christian church, but he has, in every manner consistent with his nature, fostered it as the best existent exponent of his life work on earth. So, you know, Urantia book readers, do they actually advocate trying to create something that's going to replace that which the Creator Son has spent 2,000 years fostering? I mean, shouldn't we be working with this? Let me make one other point here. You have to consider the environment in which we're working or in which we're attempting to spread this revelation. And if you look at the spiritual environment that we have, what do we have? What resources do we have? Well, we've got the Spirit of Truth. And if you look at some of the statements about the Spirit of Truth, let me read a couple of them here. The Spirit of Truth is designed to live in man and for each new generation, restate the Jesus message so that every new group of mortals to appear upon the face of the earth shall have a new and up-to-date version of the gospel. This spirit was bestowed for the purpose of qualifying believers more effectively to preach the gospel of the kingdom. And there are other quotes. You've got the Board of Planetary Supervisors, and the book tells us that this Board of Planetary Directors is especially concerned with the supervision of those activities on this world which result from the fact that Michael here experienced his terminal bestowal. You know, these primary spiritual forces are focused on reinforcing and illuminating the meanings and values of Jesus' bestowal. Shouldn't we be learning how to work with these trends, with these forces? You know, we're the foot soldiers on the ground here. We can walk up and talk to any other human being without precipitating a psychological crisis. We can do that. That's our job.
And our job is to hold up the Jesus we know and love. You know, I have not met one person that when they ask me what my religion is, and I tell them I'm a Jesusonian, they ask me, what does that mean? And I say, well, it's somebody who wants to practice the religion of Jesus rather than just a religion about him. And without fail, every single person I've said that to gets it. They get it. And they always say essentially the same thing. They always say, wow, I like that. And I have spent lots of time at the Parliament of the World's Religions, at interfaith gatherings, at New Age gatherings, talking to Hindus, talking to Muslims, talking to Christians, talking to people of all faiths, Sikhs, and they all say the same thing. They get that concept, and they like it. They like it. It's like Gandhi saying, I don't have a problem with Jesus. It's Christianity. You know, and I think that's the key right there. I wish that Christianity would just, in a sense, get over itself and quit thinking that it's, you know, that they have a fast track to heaven and nobody else is going to go, you know, and realize that in the truest sense that he who is truly great will become the server of the others.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
essentially, they're like the apostles fighting with each other about who is greatest in the kingdom. And they're still doing that. Nothing has changed. We need to quit fighting about who's greatest in the kingdom and hold these great realities up. Jesus is a cosmic being, a cosmic reality, the sovereign of our universe. And we need to hold him up no matter what. We need to hold up this great cosmic reality of Jesus so that people can see him and know him. I want to read a quote, too, which I think is crucial in this discussion because it's about the spirit of truth. And it says, it's from paper 34, The Local Universe Mother Spirit, Section 5, Ministry of the Spirit, which you wouldn't expect to find this quote here, but you do. It says, though the spirit of truth is poured out upon all flesh, this spirit of the is almost wholly limited in function and power by man's personal reception of that which constitutes the sum and substance of the mission of the bestowal Son. Well, the Urantia book gives us the sum and substance of his mission. Like no other, like nothing else. So for the spirit of truth to function at its ultimate power, people have to know the sum and substance of his mission. And to the degree that then this is how I interpret this quote, so, you know, there's, I understand probably other people would interpret it differently, but for me what it's saying is the better you know Jesus, Michael, the better you will be able to function with his spirit of truth. And this is something that the Urantia book provides a tremendous service to humanity because it's so important. Because when you get that, when you know him, now his spirit of truth is really clicking in for you. And
you know,
your filters are in full force now, you know?
I've speculated in the past that the Urantia book does not contain anything that Jesus would not have shared with us had his bestowal not been terminated so catastrophically.
Wow. Wow. You know, I think that quote from Gandhi that you're talking about, Paul, I think Gandhi was saying it's not your Christ I object to it's his followers. I think he was talking about the people as opposed to the Christianity itself. But I want to say this, and that is that David, I think there's a misperception too among some readers that Christianity is just a gospel about Jesus. But Christianity contains, yes, it is a gospel about Jesus, but it also contains the gospel of Jesus within it. That's why the book says that Christianity contains enough of Jesus' teachings to immortalize it. And if you look at a lot of the source authors that the Revelators use, this whole concept of the gospel of Jesus versus the gospel about Jesus, that's not unique to the Urantia book. that was actually coined. That whole distinction was recognized by early Christian liberal Protestant writers from the early 20th century and late 19th century. They understood that, and they didn't even have the Erancer book. They were just looking at the Bible. They were looking at Jesus' teachings. So even the greatest Christian thinkers understand that there's a difference between the gospel of Jesus and the gospel about Jesus. And I also would say that the gospel about Jesus is important, too, to some extent. You know, otherwise, the Erancer book wouldn't give us 800 pages about Jesus. You know, so I guess what I'm saying is, Jesus is part of the gospel. Part of the gospel is, you know, if you look at all the statements that Jesus makes about himself, I am the way, I am the truth. And I don't mean that, Paul, in an exclusive way, like, you know, only Christians are going to heaven. I just mean that only in the sense that, you know, part of the good news is that God has revealed himself in Christ, that he has revealed himself, that he's made himself approachable, that the infinite has become finite, that we can rejoice and know that, you know, that now we can know what God is like. We have someone who completely embodies his nature, and that's Jesus.
Well, unfortunately, again, Andre, the Erancer book clarifies that misunderstanding that Christians have, that only Christians will go to heaven because Jesus, you know, and we know that because it's talking in several senses. It clarifies up that whole misunderstanding, but I think you'll agree that Christians often interpret that teaching as to say if you're not a Christian,
right,
you're not
right,
going to heaven, you know.
Right.
And they literally think, and to their credit, they literally think they're saving you then. By converting you to Christianity, they're saving you.
Well, and I want to let David jump in here, but I will say this, that's true of fundamentalists and most evangelicals, but it's not true of a lot of Catholics, for example. A lot of Christians have broken away from that, thank God. So it's true of a certain subset of Christians, but
I think you're right to bring up the evolution that Christianity is evolving. It's an evolving religion, and thank God, you know,
that's an important concept, and it's another reason why I think Christianity is important for us to consider. Christianity is the only world religion that has a well-developed critical theological enterprise.
Right.
It's a creative critical enterprise. The other religions, as far as I know, do not have that. I know there are some streams of critical thinking within Islam. There certainly are some in Judaism, but it's not as well developed as it is in Christianity.
Yeah, and I know the number's on the screen, but I want to give out our number in case anybody wants to call in, 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. We normally get callers by this time, so I'm wondering if anybody wants to call in and comment on this. David, let me ask you this. How would it help us as readers in dialoguing with Christians? I mean, it's sort of an obvious question, but how does it help us to know the Bible better? Because this is, again, as I said before, one thing that frustrates me is biblical illiteracy among a lot of Erancer book readers. How would it help us to know the Bible better?
Well, the Bible provides a worldview that's held by more than a third of the planet's population, so it would kind of help to understand the worldview that they have. Look at the Erancer book. You know, it's given to us in a language that we can understand. It's given to us in a conceptual language that we can understand. The Revelators obviously took into consideration those things. We certainly should do that when we communicate with others. You have to have a context in which to present something. You can't present something completely new. It was something I picked up when I was at a Toastmasters class or something that said, if you're going to try to tell people something new, give them new information, you need to spend about 80% of your time telling them things they already know,
mm-hmm,
and then make your new information relative to that which you've told them that they already know.
You know, I'm so glad you said that. I'm so glad you said that, because you're picking up on something that I wanted to pick up on, which is that, you know, Jesus used the Old Testament all the time, quoted it constantly. In fact, Jesus quotes the Bible in the Erancer book more than he does in the Gospels. I mean, I can't prove that, but I'm almost positive that's the case. In fact, he quotes it at length at certain places. I think in the same way, we should be doing the same thing. We should be using both the Old and New Testament, which are scriptures, Christian scriptures, to illustrate the truths that we're trying to present. And there's a quote that I love that I've also stated before on the air, where Jesus says, I've not come to take away that which you have from your forefathers, but to give you the perfected vision of that which they saw only in part. So, and I believe the Erasmus book has done this, is here to do the same thing. It's not here to take away anything from Christianity or any other religion, frankly. It's here to give the religionists the perfected vision of that which the founders of their religions only saw only in part. But I do think that that particularly applies to Christianity, just as Jesus applied that to Judaism.
Think about what I said earlier about the Judeo-Christian stories. You know, Christianity is in my opinion, moving forward under a heavy load of its stories. Its source stories becoming more and more suspect as to their validity. And people use these stories to develop the meanings and values that they use to govern their lives. If you go into churches, I don't care whether it's in America or if it's in an Orthodox church in the East or a Catholic church in Europe, if you go into these churches, the people coming to these churches, they don't know much about the theology. They know the stories of Jesus. They have some differing beliefs about what they need to do to assure their eternal survival, and that's about it. The story of Adam and Eve and Noah's Ark and all these stories, you know, they're getting less and less likely to be true. And along comes the Urantia book and revitalizes all these fundamental stories that people use to derive the values they need to live productive and spiritual lives. That's significant, really significant.
That is significant, David. That is an amazing point. Thank you for making that point, because you are so right. It builds on those existing foundations, and it builds on the best of our spiritual heritage, and it doesn't take away anything. It just adds to everything. You know, I find it very interesting. When you go on the internet and you look at what Christians are saying about the Urantia book, their main complaint, really, is that it doesn't agree with their doctrine.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
That's their main complaint. And by their own admission, they're not saying it's not true. They're saying it doesn't agree with fundamental Christian doctrine. And they don't even say what doctrines it doesn't agree with. It's almost as though they're afraid to say it, because they know that those are sticking points for people. You know, those are sticking points for many Christians. I mean, when we interviewed Julia Dean, I mean, she has those sticking points. Lots of Christians, I think, right now are questioning their faith, and they're under attack. Let's face it, they are under attack by a scientific secular society. And I think your point is so valid, because it does offer explanations. The Urantia book offers explanations and clear, concise, logical, consistent. It just makes so much sense.
There's a very, very good chapter in a book by Dr. Ted Peters. He's an instructor at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. The title of his book is God, the World's Future. And there's a chapter in there on ecumenic pluralism, and he decries the fuzzy relativism that we've commented on. But he says you really need to have a position when you enter into dialogue. He says if you're dialoguing with somebody and they're just really radically opposing your view, he says don't get defensive. He says start asking questions, drill down, ask them to really clarify their beliefs and engage them in an articulation of their ideas. And he says, you know, we're all looking for the truth, and you can drill down and find the truth in those encounters.
Yeah. I want to also point out, Paul, you mentioned that a lot of Christians don't like the Urantia because it doesn't agree with their doctrine, or more specifically, it does not agree with everything in the Bible. And if you're a fundamentalist Christian, then you believe everything in the Bible is absolutely true. But I want to turn that around and say, you know what? I firmly believe, and this is something that some readers may disagree with me about this, but I think the Urantia book has much more in common with Christianity than it does at variance with it, especially when you look at all the different strains of Christianity that there are out there. I mean, I find, for example, the Catholic Church doesn't stress atonement as much as conservative Protestant evangelicals and fundamentalists do. But one of the things that I want to point out is that One place where I think we can start.
Andre, I've got to leave for 20 seconds. I'll be right back.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't want to continue my comments here until David comes back. So I want
to call. Let's take a caller, and then when David comes back, maybe we'll hold on. 303, you're on Block Talk.
Hi, everybody. It's Crystalyn.
Hey, Crystalyn.
Well, I was just wanting to make a reference to something, Paula, that you said.
Sorry.
Hi, Dave. It's Crystalyn.
Hey, Crystalyn. Can you now that David's back? Can I just finish my point and I'll let you talk?
No problem.
Sure. What I wanted to say was, I think one of the things that we should turn this around, this idea that your answer book differs from Christian doctrine, and talk about the places where we really do agree with Christians. And I think one place we can start, and this may surprise a lot of Christians, but the your answer book upholds and affirms the deity of Jesus Christ, that Jesus Christ is God. Now, it does say he's not the second person of the Trinity, but that's only because the your answer book is here to give us a more advanced cosmology. Okay, but the your answer book over and over and over says Jesus Christ, you know, that he embodies the fullness of God, that he is, you know, that Jesus on Salvington is like having the universal Father and the eternal Son on, you know, up there from, you know, that he rules just as effectively as if they were ruling from paradise. There's a place in the book where there's a section called On the Incarnation where it says Jesus Christ is, you know, fully God and fully man, and it was always that. That he was never. He didn't progressively become God. I mean, that's known in Christian doctrine as the hypostatic union. So there's a lot of stuff. There's so many places I could point to. We did a show on this with Brother Dave a while back about the deity of Jesus. There's so many places in the book that affirm the deity of Jesus. And this is something I think is really crucial to point out to Christian apologists, because a lot of conservative Christians will say, yeah, but the answer book doesn't say that Jesus always existed. You know, it says that he was created. Well, that's debatable, actually. It's not quite that black and white. Anyway, I'll stop rambling. I just wanted to point out that the Your Answer Book, that's one of the fundamental areas where I would argue we really agree with Christians, is on the fact that Jesus is God.
You know, Andre, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because if you go back through Christian history and look at all the different controversies about the nature of Jesus, go back and look at those. Your answer book addresses all of them. Going
Absolutely.
Back to the times of the earliest church councils, everything that's been a controversy, the book addresses. It really sets the record straight.
Yeah, and the book, and I want to make sure Crystalyn can talk here. I just wanted to say one last thing, and that is the book also rejects the Arian heresy. For those who don't know, the Arian heresy, and that's A-R-I-A-N, it was a heresy proposed by a guy named Arius, and he basically said that Jesus wasn't really God. He was sort of subordinate to God. And the book says, no, that's not true, that Athanasius, who refuted that, was right, and Arius was wrong. That's a significant thing that I think we can share, especially with more conservative-leaning Christians. Now, Crystalyn, I want to make sure that your voice is heard here.
Oh, no problem.
Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I just was told I was off the queue, so
no, you're
anyway,
on.
My point was, first of all, David, to say I'm totally supportive of the idea that you've brought forth about creating a society for Christian readers of the Your Answer Book. I think it would be a really valuable tool for many of us who are doing outreach with almost a completely Christian audience. And the other thing I wanted to comment was to have Paula tell the story that she did recently with the gentleman who said, why do I, you know, I've got the Bible, why do I need the Urantia book? And I just thought that was such a great approach you took, Paula, with the high school analogy, and I was hoping you'd share that with the audience again.
Oh, yeah, that was, I was working an expo in Canada, and I was in a really meaningful conversation with Canadians aren't as fundamental as, in my experience, as Americans are, or contrary. They don't come at you as quite as hard. They're willing to discuss it in more reasonable terms and not get angry.
And he and I were having a wonderful conversation about it, and he asked me that question very sincerely. Why, you know, if I have the Bible, why do I need the Urantia book? And I said to him, well, I said, you look like a guy who maybe has some children at home. Do you have any children? He said, yeah, I do. I have a daughter. She's 15. I said, oh, that's great. I said, and is she in high school? And he said, oh, yeah, she's a sophomore this year. And I said, is she going to college? And he said, well, yes, of course, she plans to go to college. And I said, why? And he paused for a moment. And he just looked at me, you know, with a sparkle in his eyes, and he said, I got you. I got you. And you know, sometimes I think, you know, you just need to, and I expounded on it a little bit to him. I said, you know, we have to assume that we live in a friendly and well-ordered, loving universe. We have to believe fundamentally that God loves us and that God is our loving parent and that he's brought us this far. And there's absolutely no reason why he won't take us the next step in our knowledge and education, because knowledge is a good thing. And it's not given before we're ready, but we must accept the fact that when we're ready, it is given. Because it is good, it's universally accepted that to move on, to expand, to grow, to learn is good.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes I think the best argument, you know, and I really, this is why I cherish having the years that I spent working at the booth. And I deeply, deeply miss it. Because in those moments when you get into wonderful conversations with believers, whether it doesn't matter what religion they are, you gain great insights and the Spirit moves you. And, you know, I always would proceed into any conversation with other religionists with the promise that Jesus made that in that moment God would speak through you. And I'd like to share another story, if I could, about another experience I had with two seminary students who backed me into a corner in Boston after a lecture. They actually came into my lecture, and this is for Anne, because Anne was mentioning on the board that she believes fundamentalists are going to start coming to our study groups, maybe not only to learn about the Urantia book, they could be there to learn, but she feels like they might be there to heckle too. Well, these two folks, these two men came into my audience to heckle me, deliberately to heckle me. And at the end of the lecture, I had a question and answer period, and they had a Bible with them and a Urantia book. And my point of view was interesting because I could see the whole audience. They were sitting at the back, and they said, well, you know, the Urantia book says this, and they read something from the book, which was a contradiction to their theology. And then they flipped to the Bible, and they said, but the Bible, and I saw everybody kind of hunch their shoulders. It was interesting. It was like, oh, here it comes, you know. We're going to get beat up now by the fundamentalists. And I said to them, I said, look, you know, I said, these folks came here to hear about the Urantia book, and I want to give a chance for them to ask questions. If you want to get into a theological discussion, let's take it out in the hall. And so we did.
Meet me out back.
Yeah, meet me out back. Well, I was at the end of the hall.
Take it outside.
Little did they know what big muscles they were going to be dealing with, Paula.
Well, you know, it was two men and me, and the lecture room was at the end of the hall, and they had me literally backed up against the wall, and they were balls in my face, and they were quoting, you know, the Bible, and I was quoting Jesus, but Jesus, it's just what Andre said, the Jesus of the Urantia book and the Jesus of the Bible is the same Jesus.
Absolutely.
And so I was quoting as much scripture as they were. And they kept looking at me so strange, like, why are you quoting scripture? But I kept giving them back their Jesus. And it was clear that there was no resolution to this issue. They were there to attack me. Their intentions were so clear to me. And after about 20 minutes, I said to the Heavenly Father, you know, in my heart, I said, Father, give me some words to release us from this experience because it's not serving any of us. And almost instantly, I said to the one, there were two seminary students. One was a teacher. The other one was his student. So a mentor and his student. And one was little, and the mentor was little, and the other guy was big, really big.
That's funny.
And they were kind of like Mutt and Jeff. It was just such a strange experience. But I said to the little guy, who was the teacher, and they made it clear to me who they were. They didn't hold back. I said, you know, there must be 5 billion Bibles on the planet. I said, there's only 300,000 Urantia books. What is it about the Urantia book that threatens you so much? And man, this guy could not answer that question. And the more he thought about it, he shut down. It started an internal process in him. He literally tried to answer that question in his own heart.
That's really good.
He couldn't answer. That was God, David. Because I prayed for that, see? And he came through. And that's a technique that I swear by. It works every time. It just, fear not, as Jesus said, for in that hour my Father will speak through you. And the little guy shut down. He could not answer that question, and he got quieter. And the more quiet he got, the more animated and boisterous the big guy got. He was literally jumping up and down. And finally, I said, look, you guys, this is silly. I said, you're not going to change my mind. There's no way on earth you will ever dissuade me from reading the Urantia book. It's just never going to happen. It's not going to happen. And I said, let's just leave it at that and go.
Well, you know what, Paula? I just thought of something as you were talking. I have an idea, and I'm gonna issue a challenge to you, Paul, and see how you think about this. Since you're so good at this, and since you're so good at dialoguing with people, I think on our next open phone segment, we're gonna try a little exercise. I'm gonna play the role of a fundamentalist Christian for the whole show, and you can dialogue with me, and I'm gonna give you every sword I remember from the closet that I because I was a fundamentalist Christian for a long time. And I went, for some of you may know that I went back and forth between the Urantia book and fundamentalist Christianity for a long time. So I know every trick in the book. So I'm gonna, because for example, you were asking them what's so threatening to them about the Urantia book. Well, I can tell you what probably is. I think the thing that really threatens them the most is the atonement doctrine, is the fact that the Urantia book rejects that.
But the reason he couldn't answer the question was because of my premise that there are 6 billion Bibles on Earth.
Right. Right.
And only 300,000
right.
Urantia.
Right, I see
what you're saying. And at that time, that was accurate, by the way.
Yeah, okay.
Well, what is it about, this little, tiny, little thing that you would come out of your seminary, come to my lecture, pay to get in, to sit here and heckle me about it? What is it? Why, you've gone to a lot of trouble today for a book
that...
He
never could answer that?
He couldn't answer it, David. He couldn't. There's just it started a problem. And I, to this day, I wonder about that fellow, if he ever could figure it out in his own heart, because he knew the truth and I did. There's something about the authority of which this book speaks. There's something about this book that troubles you, but it's not the fact that it's knocking the world over, you know? It ain't
changing
the world.
Well, there's an issue of fear. There's an issue of fear, I think, in some Christians' lives. They fear that some new information is going to undermine their faith. Dr. Peters, in his book I referred to earlier, has a great comment. He says, if the God in which Christians believe is in fact the creator of the cosmos and the gracious reconciler of all that is separate, then there is no truth, if it be genuine truth and not partisan propaganda, that one could ever learn that could possibly lead away from God.
Wow.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
That's
also so consistent with what Jesus said, too. You know, he really, his gospel was really about helping people to get out of that fear-based mentality of the law and that strict adherence to the law as opposed to the spirit of truth, the spirit of the law.
Wow.
And I believe that is just as prevalent today in Christianity as it probably was then in Judaism.
It's kind of funny. Christianity is an interesting mix because I having been a fundamentalist for a long time, I can tell you that it's interesting because on the one hand they talk about having a personal relationship with God and experiencing God's love, but then they have this other stuff mixed in. It's kind of you know this legalism and, as you said, Crystal, this adherence to the law and this fear. It's like they're trying to reconcile two things that are irreconcilable. Love and fear are not reconcilable. They're incompatible with each other. You can't have, that's why, it even says in the Bible that, that perfect love casts out fear. So,
Hey, listen, we have
very good point.
Let's take another call, shall we?
Yes.
Yeah.
301, you're on Blog Talk. 301, are you still with us?
I wonder if that's Chris that has been calling in the last few times.
Hello? 301?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
You're on Blog Talk.
Ah, yeah. How is everybody? It's Chris. I didn't expect to be on the phone, but...
Very good to hear from you. Very good to hear from you.
I'm a little late.
Did you want to make a comment, or were you just listening in today?
I was just listening in today, but I didn't want to say hi to everybody, so I guess just automatically. I was waiting for a good time to say hi. I guess I came in now.
Hi, Chris. Well, we have another caller, too, so hold on.
All
right. 514, you're on Blog Talk.
Hello.
Hello, Diane.
Hi, Andre. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, David. So beautiful to hear your voice. Hi, Kristalyn.
Great to be here.
Hey, Diane.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. It's a three-part comment, and it has to do on what you've been talking about, David, that Christianity is an evolving religion. And listening to you, by the way, it is most fascinating, today's program. And you were saying, David, that Christianity is an evolving religion, and then you were all discussing, the three of you, on the fact that Christianity is so important. And then it just occurred to me that, number one, first part of my statement is that all other religions may talk about God and the rest of what the beliefs are and all this, but at the same time, to me, the core nucleus of life here on earth is to develop our souls to ascend to heaven for eternal life. So to me, Urantia is like a sprouter. I don't know if you remember when I did the program with you, Andre and Paula, I talked about a sprouter, a sprouting machine. And I see earth as a nursery, a breeding ground for souls. And that is really, really important, to sprout our souls so that we can ascend to eternal life. And that is done by believing in God the Father and all his family and all the rest. So when we look at the Urantia book, and I'm saying this for the non-readers because sometimes they need some inspiration or whatever, and I was just thinking about the Urantia book and realizing that when you look at the core of the Urantia book itself, when we go right down to around paper 100, okay, it's all about religion, religare, this connection between the person and God, and then faith in God, the thought adjuster, and then the soul. And so that is the core. And then we are enwrapped by the beginning of the book, which is all about God, and then the end of the book, which is his creator son, Jesus, and his whole life and teachings. So it's like we're all, our souls are all enwrapped by God and his creator son. And so the reason why, to me, Christianity is way beyond everything else is because it's the trilogy that comes as the third part of that message, which started first part of the trilogy with Judaism when Jesus appeared here on earth among the Jews, the Jewish people, and then Christianity, which has done what we all know that it has done, and then the third part, the Urantia book community that is growing and growing and growing around the world. So the Urantia book is the clarifier that sheds light on this whole subject. And because the core issue is our soul,
We may talk until we're blue in the face about God. We may talk about everything else. But if we do not get out of this nursery home, this that we call Earth or Urantia for Urantia Book Readers, by having developed, sprouted our souls, then the goal is not achieved. So this is why we have to develop our soul, and the Urantia Book does that, and is the continuity of Christianity. So I just wanted to say that.
Okay, before anybody says anything else, too, we have Anne, and she wants to make a comment real quick.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Anne.
Hi, Anne.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Anne.
Paula.
Hi, Anne.
Andre. And
hey,
hello,
there.
David. We've really enjoyed
yes,
you.
Yes, hello.
I've had some ongoing problems getting sound, but I've been listening. As Paula mentioned earlier, one of the study groups I'm co-facilitate, we did have two young fundamentalist seminarian students show up. And as time went by, Paula, I mentioned in the chat room that I actually called a friend of mine who's been a pastor for 35 years and does privately, quietly read the Urantia Book, which, by the way, I believe is happening a lot. We just don't know about it.
Yeah.
And he agreed to come, and we didn't tell the young man where he was or anything, because they would actually, I knew, and he knew also that they would show up there. And interestingly enough for me, we begin to realize, and I say we, the core group, the co-facilitator, the pastor, my husband and I, these young men were actually sent. They were sent there week after week. And in some ways they had success because we were very strong with them as far as we're not going to allow you to come in here to undermine the group. But they got involved with some of the other younger people, you know, through the Internet and began to undermine. So I just wanted to let you tell you this experience. And, you know, as you know, Paula, we've had a lot of experiences with fundamentalists at the expos. But I believe that we need to be very prepared for this more and more as time goes by, that the more attention we bring that happens because of all the different outreach, that they will begin to try to undermine the Christian fundamentalists will. That is,
you know,
I
got to tell you, Paul, Anne, that surprises me because I know they're aggressive, but I didn't think they'd be that. That's really disrespectful. It'd be like somebody going to their group to, you know, be like us going to their group to try to undermine them.
But this is a very, very conservative seminary, and the father of one of the sons is a longtime professor there.
Okay.
We've had them show up at interfaith gatherings also, not these young men, but we've had fundamentalists show up at interfaith gatherings, fundamentalists of all religions, by the way.
Okay.
It gets back to Andre's earlier point about the importance of biblical literacy in the Urantia community. It's really important. I think that there's a huge internal educational effort that needs to be made within the Urantia Book readership community, and biblical literacy should be a big part of that.
Absolutely.
I totally agree, and that's why I realized, even with my biblical background, that I needed, we needed more assistance in that area. That was my, you might say, the acid test on what these young men were all about. And the problem is, the older people were hiding behind those young men. You understand? They were, and that's typical. They sent them out. You understand what I'm saying? And that's what they'll do. And I will tell you, these young men, one of them especially, he was very good, because when you're in a study group and you're reading the Urantia Book and they know the Bible, and then you've got new readers, it can really create issues for the study group, because there are quotes in the Urantia Book the good news is it's caused me to go back and start studying the Bible even in a deeper level, because there are times that there are quotes that are run together in the Urantia Book that are not directly quoted from the Bible in the same way, even in paper.
But this
one.
is all, uh, this is a part of the reason why I want to see if we can't develop this virtual society, because it would enable us to take a more proactive approach here, not just wait for somebody to be coming along attacking us, but we make a proactive approach.
Absolutely.
We reach out to these communities, and we engage in internal education, and hopefully can be ahead of any of those kind of waves. Unfortunately, I've seen over the years this fear of fundamentalism, or this fear of what might happen if Christians find out about the Urantia Book. We should not be operating on a fear basis like that. We should be operating on a proactive basis. We have tremendous spiritual resources at our disposal for this.
Well, not only that, David, and I want to ask you, Ann, how these guys found out about your study group. But before you answer that question, I want to say, not only is there biblical illiteracy among the Urantia movement, but I find that there are readers that don't even care. It's not just that they don't know, they don't care, and they don't think it's important. And I've heard so many. I did a workshop last summer in L.A. about this very topic, about how to serve the needs of readers from Christian backgrounds. Hey, one guy in the workshop just stood up and talked about how terrible Christianity was and how horrible it was. And there's just so much of this, unfortunately. Not as much as it was in the past. I'll grant you, it's getting better. But I do see a lot of Christian bashing, unfortunately, among readers, because I think when they think of Christians, they just think, oh, they're all just a bunch of narrow-minded fundamentalists, when Christianity is actually much broader than that. And even among conservative Christians, there are evangelicals who are more moderate. So it's really a much broader spectrum than a lot of people may think. So, and Anne, how did they find out about your study group?
One of the young readers who had not read the entire Urantia Book, and this will happen, you know. They were actually on the campus at another interfaith gathering. Mm-hmm. And as we begin to research it, when I say research, I begin to ask, how'd this happen, you know. They were there also to undermine what was going on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had this to happen in the past. I want you to know this is not the first time. I have had people show up in the past who found out about study groups on the internet or word of mouth, and we dealt with it and moved on. However, they had to make a choice, and that was our point. And I say our, I always, you know, I dealt with the leader, you might say, privately. I said, you're going to have to make a choice.
Well, you know what's interesting, though, Anne?
Let me finish, Andre, because I have
sure,
to go.
Sure, sure.
I'm sorry. I have people waiting on me. I said, you're going to have to make a choice. He said, this is not lining up with the Bible. I said, you're going to have to make a choice. I'm hearing a lot of doctrine from you. And that man that was here a month ago, the older gentleman, in my opinion, you did not pay him proper respect, because by the middle of the study group, you realized he had been a pastor 30-something years. And I said, this is not going to line up with doctrine. You're involved with a lot of doctrine, and you're correct. You're going to have to read the entire book and tie it together. You can't come to study group for 2 months or 3 months. And so that's what we tried to do with them, to give them that choice. And right now, we've quietly had to back off for a while because they were going to bring some more people. And we have to be careful with the young readers. You see what I'm saying? They're confused. So,
yeah.
David, I'm glad that you're bringing this up, because people say, I know some people say, well, I'd have done this or this or this differently. We don't know until we're faced with it in person or on the web. And Paula, you're one of the best. And David, I love the way what you've said. Yes, we must be prepared for this as time goes by.
You know, and I want to add, Anne, to what, you know, my story about the two seminary students shows me, if they were threatened when we had 300,000 books in print, imagine how threatened they'll be when we have 2 million. I mean, it's not going to get better. And I think that you bring up a very good point. And David's whole one of his reasons, and maybe you can expound on this, David, for doing this, is so that we can really start to reach out and create a way to support this for many reasons, because we have to be prepared. It's going to happen sooner or later. We need to be prepared for the onslaught in all ways.
I agree, Paula.
That's a part of my purpose of trying to put together this society, Paula. And if you look at the initial information that I sent out, I listed some of the things that this society would do. Its members would engage in dialogue with individual Christians or communities of Christians who may have questions or criticisms of material contained in the Urantia book. We have a tremendous internal educational effort to do there. We should be cultivating liaison persons who are biblically literate, who can talk with interested people.
Oh, I'm in, Dave. I want to do this.
You know, I'm not talking about just endless bantering with fundamentalists where you're not going to get anywhere, but there are
that's
going
it.
To be
that's,
genuinely...
That's a very good point. When it turns into bantering, let it go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where we came to. In West Point, we dealt with them privately. Those young men, I said, you know, just keep... Stay where you are. Stay with what you know right now, because right now you're just not even here to listen. And when you get to that place, it's better just to let it go and encourage them not to come back to study group. I hate to say that, guys, but there comes a time you have to
do that.
No,
you need to do that.
Yeah, you have to. And I had a group, you know, we had a group consensus there.
Ann, did you hear my earlier quote of Paul in 2 Corinthians?
Oh, yes. I love that.
Okay.
I love
well,
that.
Yeah.
Can I say
good
something?
Guiding quote.
And I have to, I apologize. I have to leave early. I have some folks waiting on me.
Thanks
so
for joining us.
Okay. Love you guys so much.
Thank
love
you, Ann.
Thank
bye,
you
Ann.
For your participation. Yes.
I want to.
Can I say something? Just a little sentence.
Go ahead, Ann. Ann, go ahead.
Because of what David and Anne have been saying, I was just reminded of this beautiful expression that says, all truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Then it is violently opposed. And then third, it is accepted as being self-evident. So when Schopenhauer wrote that, I think that it is to remind us that if we stay in the consciousness of what is the process, what is happening, then it's going in the right direction. The only thing is not to lose faith, to stay centered, to stay focused, you know, and it is, if it is violently opposed, then your approach, David, is wonderful. It's exactly in line with that.
But you know what's interesting? I want to go back to something you said, Paul. You said that it's not going to get any better. I have to say, though, I'm more optimistic about that, about it than that. I think I see a growing movement of young people, and you know, and as we had Julia Dean on the show, even though Julia Dean's sticking with the Bible, you know, she's been, for those of you who don't know, we had a guest named Julia Dean on the show in the past who wrote a book called Quitting Church. She is a reporter for the Washington Times, and you know, I read her columns regularly, and she says that, you know, even she is saying the old icons are falling, the old answers are not working anymore. And I just think there is a growing chorus of people, particularly young people, but not I'd say everywhere from the 20s to the 50s, really, I mean, of people who are they're Christians, they love Christianity, but they're frustrated with what they're getting in church, and they want more, and they're dissatisfied. Their souls are not being nourished. So I actually do think it's going to get better. On the one hand, there'll be opposition, yes. But I just think that, you know, part of the reason for the opposition is because a lot of these churches are desperate because people are leaving. They're leaving the church. On the other hand, though, fundamentalists, the flip side of that, though, is the churches that are growing do tend to be conservative because a lot of the mainline churches are not offering people a lot. They're kind of offering people politics or they're offering people a social club, and so their membership has really dwindled in the past 20, 30 years. But anyway, I do think it's going to get better. I think that we have a lot to look forward to.
Well, I agree, Andre, but I also think though that some of the worst persecutors sometimes become the best, the biggest fans later, like Paul.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
I think we will go through some persecutions. I mean, we already have. You know, I think what troubles me more than anything is when we persecute each other.
Yeah,
and
that's true. That is true.
That's the mistake Christianity has made. And, you know, I think the lesson of the Urantia book certainly is tolerance. Tolerance for all points of view, tolerance for all of God's children. I mean, Jesus was so clear when he said, you know, and in speaking of which, I mean, this is a discourse from Jesus that isn't in the Bible.
And it's my one of my very, very favorites. It's the Discourse on Religion and the Second Discourse on Religion. And my very favorite is the Second Discourse. And he tells us uncategorically, and he tells the apostles, but he's telling us, too, that unity, uniformity, is not possible. We will never all think alike. We can't. It's just not possible. We can have unity of spirit and unity of purpose and goal, but we will never have uniformity of belief. And to me, that is just such a vital teaching. It's absurd that we imagine that we can. And the more that we come to embrace our fellow man, you know, the more that we realize that it has to become both and, not either or.
Well, uniformity is not even desirable. It wouldn't even be desirable if we all thought the same way.
It would be boring.
Right.
We're not an anti.
Well, you know, it's one thing to have everybody thinking the same way. It's another thing to have a collection of stories that integrate a culture. You know, as I try to study earlier civilizations, it seems to me that they do just fine as long as there's a story that's kind of generally accepted by everybody. And as that story begins to lose credence, the civilization begins to fall apart. Now, that's a real overgeneralization. But I think it's a valid point that these stories are important. They're important to bridge the gap between our evolutionary immaturity and our more mature state in the future as more spiritually living people. But in the meantime, these stories are important. And I think that's why the Urantia book, as an epical revelation, is reinforcing and revitalizing the fundamental stories of Judeo-Christian culture.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, David, you know, can you kind of give us a synopsis of where you see evolution going? I mean, the humanity, where do you see us going from here? What are some of the, if we could get you to be a soothsayer for a minute, what do you envision is going to happen, say, in the next couple hundred years with the Urantia book and with human civilization?
Boy, it's hard to say. You know, one of the things that Svetlana and I tell ourselves from time to time is the old saying that if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans for the future. You know, evolution is basically a creative process, and it will develop in response to the free will choices that are being made moment by moment by everybody on the planet. What it will be in the future, I simply cannot say. But what we can be involved in doing is trying to transform the processes by which individuals make those choices, and that means helping them to grasp higher values relative to which they can choose and act. That, to me, is the bottom line, and that's what we need to be doing.
I agree. We have a – Crystalline has a question for you. So, Crystalline, did you have a question for David?
Yes, I did. I wanted to ask you, David, if you could tell us a little bit about what your background is religiously before
My
you came to the Urantia book.
You know, I came to the Urantia book when I was really young. I mean, I was in university and searching. I was reading everything I could find. I'd grown up in this fundamentalist environment that just was very stifling, but I seemed to have a sense that there was a reality there somewhere that needed to be found. I mean, my introduction to meditation was as a young kid sitting in church trying to make this church service end with my mind. concentration long enough and pretend that the church service was over, voila, after a short time it was over.
What was the denomination you grew up in?
Southern Baptist.
Wow.
But, you know, I found the Urantia book early on in that journey. I was maybe 18 years old, 20 years old, and after reading it for a year or so, I went to Chicago and talked with the folks there and just... at that point, I told them, I said, you know, I'm a young person here. I intend to spend the rest of my life working with this. Help me get oriented here as to what needs to be done. And know, that's been my life. I mean, I've had a professional life apart from that just to earn a living and live life, but the real focus has been on doing what I can to get this book spread around the planet. And the internet certainly was an important development, absolutely essential to what we're doing.
So it sounds to me like, in a way, David, you, like many of us, you initially rejected religion, but not God. Would you say that's true?
I would say that's true. In fact, just because of my background, when I first started reading the Urantia book, I thought this, if anything, is really a satanic trick to take these basic stories and just kind of tweak them a little bit. You know, I was really quite not frightened, but metaphysically concerned. But the more I read, you know, that those fears were allayed. But that was kind of an initial reaction. It was a real metaphysical fear, I should say.
Do you think you would have continued? You would have been a Christian had you not found the Urantia book?
If I hadn't found the Urantia book, I probably would have been a Buddhist.
A Buddhist. Would you? If I asked you, David, what religion are you? What would you say?
Oh, you know, I hate the categorization. I would have to take your categorization of a Jesusonian.
You know, that's the only one that I have found that universally appeals to everybody I've talked to. And it doesn't have any baggage.
Yeah.
And
yes.
Given that that's your sort of current self-description, how do you sort of make the argument then for the Christians, you know, the Society for Christian Readers of the book?
Well, can you ask your question in a different way? Tell me.
Well, I think I know what Crystal's getting at because I actually do call myself a Christian, Dave, and I think what, correct me if I'm wrong, Crystal, I think what you're saying is if David, if you're going to do this Christian society, why not just call yourself a Christian as opposed to a Jesusonian?
Well, I do in some contexts, and I should be upfront with that, and I should actually say that yes, I do consider myself a Christian.
Okay.
The Jesusonian is a good term, but you know, the Christian family is huge, absolutely huge. I've really enjoyed getting to know a little bit about the Eastern family, the Eastern Orthodox tradition. It's another huge family of Christianity, and it's really diverse. You know, your Urantia book says don't overlook your spiritual heritage, that river running down through the ages, blah,
right,
blah, blah.
Right,
exactly.
And that's really important. It's a tremendous heritage. You know, the art, architecture, and literature that has come from this in just 2,000 years, the educational systems, you know, you don't find atheist hospitals or atheist orphanages. This is an important heritage.
That's a really good point.
Throw it out.
That is a good, isn't it? And where are the atheists helping humanity?
Yeah.
I have to share this story too, David, because it's so important. And David and I were talking the other day, and we were talking about atheism and some of these topics. And I mentioned being at the Parliament in South Africa in 1999. And I have to do a plug for the Parliament of the World's Religions right here, because anybody can go to a parliament. They happen every 5 years. The first one was in 1893. They didn't do another one for 100 years, and they've had one every 5 years since then, just about. I mean, there was a six-year gap in the first one. They're trying to do them every 5 years. I've been to all of them in this century, or in the last 100 years. And
you're not that old.
Didn't go to 1893, but I've been to the rest of them. And in 1999, we had a parliament in South Africa. Crystalline was there with me. The opening plenary session, Nelson Mandela got up to speak to the group. It was one of the most moving things, because here is this human hero, this man who has persevered. This is the kind of man that if you have a chance to hear someone like him speak, you just do whatever you can to get there to hear him speak. And to be there and to hear him do the opening session of the Parliament of the World's Religions was just beyond magical for me. And what he said was something I'll never forget. He said,
I want to honor all of you. He said, because when I was languishing in a prison off the coast of South Africa, nobody cared about me. He said, I am here. I am alive and here on this podium speaking to you because of you. He said, when I had nothing, when nobody in the world cared about me, you did. He said, it was the Hindus and the Muslims and the Christians who went out of their way to come and minister to me and give me hope and give me courage. And that's why I'm here tonight. So I want to say thank you to all of you. And it was so moving and so poignant and so true. We often tend to see only the bad in religion. And sure, religion, like all of humanity, has its pathology. If taken to the extreme, it can be absolutely ludicrous. On the other hand, religionists have done so much to lift up humanity.
Well, and you know what, Paula? It's also because of the teachings of Jesus, too. I mean, it's because of the teachings of Jesus that we have orphanages and hospitals and, you know, those kinds of things. I think if it wasn't for because before the teaching, I mean, let's just take, for example, how we view children. You know, children, I think children are considered, you know, a precious resource by most people in Western society. Why? Because of Jesus' love for children. You know, before Jesus, I mean, the pagans would take, if they didn't want a child, they would just take the child and throw it out, you know, into the cold, you know, and say, you know, goodbye, fend for yourself, you know.
Well, but there are many other religions also that deeply value children and that deeply value caring for poor and sick and injured people.
That's especially true of Islam.
Yeah, especially true of Islam and also of many Eastern faiths, including Buddhism. So,
What I'm saying though is supported even by the Arantia book. There's a place in the Arantia book where they even say that they talk about Christ's attitude toward children and how it. I'm not saying that the other religions don't have that. I'm just saying to you. I guess one thing I would say is that the teachings of Jesus may have influenced even those other religions. You know, so that's another. You know, I'm just saying that prior to the teachings of Jesus, if you look at, one of the things that the pagans laughed at Christians for is how they treated children. You know, they thought it was stupid. They thought it was stupid that they would you know, preserve the lives of you know, children that were weak and things like that. So it's
just, someday, Andre, I think the world is going to realize the impact that Jesus had on it. I don't think it's fully set in yet, but we know as an epical revelation, that's huge. That's absolutely huge. As our bestowal, that's huge. He was the creator of the universe, and only one world in a whole universe gets that great and grand privilege of having Creator Son bestowed upon it. That's huge. And, you know, it's like that great little saying that I love to quote often, the solitary life. You know, all the armies that ever marched, all the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, all the kings that ever reigned have not affected the life of man on this earth as much as that one life. And to me, wow. That is just like, you got to think of it. You got to let that sink in, because the world literally dates its clock to him.
You know, Paula, that you earlier referenced the quote, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. I think it's important to think about that and to appreciate the implications of that. If you accept a Jungian worldview, if we can look at that worldview for a moment, we could say that the planetary prince arrives on a planet to establish the archetypes for the collective unconscious of the planet, and that collapsed. The next archetypal bestowal was the Adamic bestowal, and that collapsed. Jesus is a planetary prince because he is the primary spiritual archetype for the collective unconscious of the planet. He didn't become planetary prince just because, oh, you're a good guy here, we give you this little star you can wear on your shirt, you know, you're planetary prince. No, it's a psychological, spiritual, existential reality that he is the planetary prince, and he will draw all people to him if he's lifted up.
Wow.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is Crystal, and I have one more comment, and then I'd like to just get off the air and open up some more phone lines. But I wanted to say that as an interfaith activist and someone who has worked most of my life also within a Christian context, I have found that there has been a tendency, and I find this to be true among your Rancho greeters as well, to sometimes denigrate Christianity. And I've been in groups of interfaith, a group that would call itself an interfaith group that has been involved in sort of Christian bashing. And I frequently had to have been the one who stood up and said, hey, wait a minute, you know, if we are really going to stand for interfaith principles, we also have to validate all different religious points of view here. And I find it interesting that, at least in some circles, your idea of having a Christian Urantia Book Society has met with some resistance. And just would like to hear you talk a little bit more about that.
About resistance?
Well, just about the resistance that we found that you've met with within the Urantia community.
I wouldn't classify it as resistance. I would classify it maybe as reluctance. Going all the way back to the earliest 1955 gatherings, I mean, as I read through stuff, there seems to be this fear of having the book identified with any religion, and particularly
right.
Christianity, and kind of an anti-Christian feeling. I remember one of the ICs that was held a few years back. I asked the people who were planning the worship program, I said, well, what are you going to do for worship at this IC? And I was told in no uncertain terms, well, we certainly aren't going to do any of that Christian stuff. You know, there's this kind of anti-Christian stuff in the readership. I have personally felt marginalized because I've taken a little bit
I agree with you 100%
view of Christianity.
Yeah.
And I think that needs to be brought out into the open, and I think controversy and discussion and dialogue are good, and they're important, and they're essential to moving forward. If we have just this kind of fuzzy, well, I don't want to have any conflict with anybody about ideas, we'll all just get along here so that we demonstrate the brotherhood of man. I mean, we're not going to get anywhere that way. We've got to take some action. We've got to move forward. The world needs this revelation, and we've got to experiment and find ways of getting it out that are going to be effective. And if we can do that, we will all the sooner eliminate a lot of the ongoing human suffering that's going on in the world today. Tremendous.
Absolutely. And David, I want to make sure, David, that you get a chance to. I don't know if you've got a website yet for the society, but I want to make sure you get your contact info out there. How much time do we have left, Paula?
Well, we have 7 minutes, and we have a new caller too.
Okay. I want to just really quickly. I know it's off the subject, but I just wanted to so you guys know. I did find the quote in the Urantia book that I was looking for. It's in paper 195, section 3. About how the teachings of Jesus affected children, and it says this: the teaching regarding Christ's love for children soon put an end to the widespread practice of exposing children to death when they were not wanted, particularly girl babies. So, anyway, I just thought that was an interesting. That's just another example of how there are so many ways in which Jesus' teachings have permeated, our culture in ways that we probably take for granted.
Yeah, I think he permeates whether we know it or not. It's just what David was saying. He's the planetary prince. His spirit of truth is here on the planet. You know, my point earlier that if we want him to be more effective in upstepping our evolution, we have to hold him up so people will come to know him, and then his spirit of truth will be that much more effective in doing its work. That's my belief, anyway. Shall we take that call?
Yes, let's do it.
Yeah.
603, you're on Blog Talk.
Hi, Paul and Andre. This is Lewis calling.
Hey, Lewis.
I've been listening to the whole show, and I have a few comments. The very first one is, I know we're running out of time, so I'll speak quickly. I want to affirm David's theme throughout the whole thing about the importance of the commonality of stories upon which we can build when we outreach to mainstream Christians. I know I work with two mainstream Christian ladies, and if I'm talking about God in the abstract or theology in the abstract or eternal life in the abstract, it never resonates as when I'm able to expand upon the stories of, say, Noah or Adam and Eve or Moses leading the slaves out of the desert. This is something upon which we can build and shed more light. The second is, feeds into this sort of Urantian anti-Christian thing, which I've seen in the past, and I agree with Andre, I don't think it's as prevalent as it once was, but it also feeds into what David has been saying. This huge number of mainstream Christians in the world, this is the standing army upon which the Urantian movement will draw from in future times, maybe sooner, maybe later, but this is the most fertile ground, at least immediately, because of the commonality of stories, again, going back to the common, the overlap of the heritage. Now, I'm happy to say I've observed the sort of smug attitude of some Urantians against mainstream Christians. I've seen that abate over the years, and I'm really glad about that. But I also see how this pool of believers is probably most ripe to accept the teachings of the Urantian book.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me jump in. I absolutely agree with you, Lou, and I think that if you were to poll the existing Urantian movement, you would find that probably 80%, and that's probably a conservative estimate, 80% came from a background of Christianity. They were Christians.
And I wonder what percentage...
Many are still practicing Christians. They go to church every Sunday.
Yeah.
They are involved in Bible study, deeply involved in their various religious communities. So, you know, I think that, you know, my friend Mo Siegel would say, feed the center and starve the fringe, which, you know, I don't think we need to do that. But I don't think we can afford to ignore the fact that 80% of us come from a Christian background. That should tell us something. This book is resonating with us for a reason. And the other 20% are probably predominantly Judeo background. So that's the foundations. There they are. That's our foundation.
And is there a website, David? Is there a website where we can get going with you? And
There will be. It's kind of in the works. I will let folks know when that's up and running.
Good.
Well, I would love to see you come back to this show again, if I can be so bold as to make that request, because I think this has been a very dynamic topic, and I think we've barely scratched the surface.
Well, I think we've barely scratched the surface, too. You know, I see that the clock is ticking down here, and I would like to offer one more little piece of scripture here that I really like. You know, John's gospel is so beautiful. The beginning of that gospel is so beautiful. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Without him was not anything made that was made. It's such a beautiful piece of scripture. And John goes through his gospel and gives this whole story about Jesus, and then he concludes the last verse in his gospel, John 21:25, he says, "And there are also many other things which Jesus did, the which, if they should be written every one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written."
Hear, hear. I frequently use that quote from the Bible.
Well, that's the beauty of knowing the Bible, you know.
Yeah.
There's some beautiful things in there, absolutely beautiful, and they can be used to bridge the gap between ourselves and very well-meaning religionists. There are heroic Christians out there serving the Master in ways that we can't even imagine under brutal circumstances. We need to be getting some reinforcements to those folks, some
absolutely
conceptual reinforcements.
David, how do listeners contact you if they want to find out more about the Society?
They can contact me. My email address is dkantor606@yahoo.com.
And that's K-A-N-T-O-R, right?
dkantor606@yahoo.com.
Congratulations for your project, David.
Well, thank you for your support. We've got a lot of work to do.
Thanks for being on our show.
I send you all my love.
I'd love to have you back to talk about the Supreme sometime, which I know is a favorite subject of yours. So.
Well, we'll see what we can do. We'll see if you and Andre survive your upcoming bout.
Okay.
That'll be fun. We should do that. I'll see if I can do it in a way that people won't even know it's me. I'll have to put on one of my vocal hats or something.
Well, thank you for letting me be on the show.
I'm sorry?
Can I say something real quick? I wanted to point out the difference between the two books. Like I said last time, affirming what I said last time with the length of the Urantia book versus the Bible, one thing that you can say is that the Urantia book, it kind of gives you more of an understanding of what's going on. The Bible kind of tells you what happened, but the Urantia book will give you a more of an understanding of everything. And that kind of proves even what was just said about how Jesus was said to be, how he became the planetary prince. It was because, you know, of all these details that you find in the Urantia book. It's not going to be in the Bible. So you have all these additional, you know, it takes, just like it says in the book, there's three levels. You have the horizon, and then you have the horizontal, then you have the vertical. Well, the Urantia book, the Bible takes you on the horizontal, but the Urantia book's going to get your thinking into the vertical. So, I mean, if there's questions about that, that's where I usually go with my friends and things like that. They understand more what the Bible doesn't explain. That's explained in the Urantia book. So I just wanted to point that out.
That's good. That's a very good point.
Good comment.
Well, thanks. I guess we'll give you the last word then. And thanks again, David, and all of our listeners, and thank you for all of our callers. Keep coming.
Thank you
back
for the opportunity to participate. We'll talk soon, I'm sure.
Sure appreciate
thank you.
It.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Bye, David.
Now, everyone.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. If you would like more information about the Urantia Book, or if you just have comments or questions, please feel free to email us at cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. That's cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.